That's Chicago's Richard Muhal Abrams and his orchestra with Blue, Blue, Blue. He spells it B-L-U. It's a title track from his extraordinary 1991 album. Richard Muhal Abrams is a world-renowned bandleader, pianist, composer, arranger, clarinetist, cellist, and educator, and has been in the forefront of the free jazz and contemporary music scene for half a century. Although he enrolled to study music at Roosevelt University, he said he didn't learn much about music there. Instead, he engaged in rigorous, independent study, self-taught. Today, he's about 84, 85, somewhere in that vicinity. The much-awarded Richard Muhal Abrams still stands apart in the world of jazz as a visionary, iconoclast, and a genuine genius. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, June the 18th, and sad, sad news coming out of South Carolina. The sad news, as you know, or you may know, is just last night, as the congregants of the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church gathered for Bible study, they found that their program was violently interrupted with a barrage of gunfire coming from a young man, a young white man, who, according to members of the congregation who witnessed the event, had been with other members as they assembled for more than an hour before he began to fire at them, killing 9 people, including the pastor of the church, and wounding others. But today, after an all-points bulletin was issued, we are learning that he was, in fact, captured. The manhunt yielded his capture in North Carolina, and about 220 miles away from the scene in Charleston where this tragedy occurred. And we get to know the identity of the young man, Dylan Roof, 21 years old. We do not know it is not reported yet what the motivation for this crime was. And many questions abound as to why this happened and what happens now. The victims, among them, were predominantly women, 6 women and 3 men, including the pastor of the church, as I said, the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, who also is an elected member of the state senate. Well, of course, we are seeing the customary official reactions of people decrying and condemning the action of Dylan Roof, who recently was given a gift of a handgun. And we don't know very much about his background and his associates and, again, his motivation for this crime. But what we do know is that U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch has said that her office is investigating whether to charge Roof with a hate crime motivated by racial or other prejudice. That's a special kind of hate crime under federal statutes and under her authority to charge a person with. These crimes supposedly carry heavier and harsher penalties upon conviction. But the question really, to me, is that although this is already being described as a hate crime, the question is it in fact a hate crime or is this something else? Why do I think it might be something else, or why do I believe that in any event we need to revisit this categorization of hate crimes? Because it removes the act from the historical context. And when seen in historical context, an act such as this takes on a dimension far greater to me, in my opinion, than simply a hate crime. Because it fits within a particular history of race-based terrorism in service of white supremacy. Now, it is strange, isn't it, that in the last week I've been concentrating on these kinds of discussions, because it is my view that we are way past due the time to get real about things. And certainly we can't wait for a system to get real about anything, because the system got real about things centuries ago. It set its vision, for lack of a better term, what it desires, how it sees this country and how it ought to be run. It imposed the laws, it created the laws, it enforced the laws. It's in charge. It has a system designed to suit its race-based vision. And it's a very elaborate system that is all-encompassing on just about every single level. And when we look at the evolution of life in the South with the history of slavery, and not just the South, let's be very clear that New York City, this supposedly very progressive city, was the largest processor of slaves. So nobody is exempt. No part of the United States is exempt in this regard. It is a total society predicated on not just race and racism, but even more extreme. It's an extremist form of racism called race oppression. So when these things are occurring and we are presented them in the context of news, this is an isolated incident, this is a hate crime, all the ways of defining these events, what we always have to keep in mind is that at the same time that they're defining these events, they are also redefining our consciousness and our reality as it pertains to these events. What do I mean? A crime such as this immediately should trigger in the hearts and minds of anybody even remotely connected to the history of this country that it is simply an evolution. It is simply a new dimension of an old experience framed by this system, this interlocking, integrated system that has one key agenda, and that is white supremacy. And if we are being real, we see it in that light. This is not a hate crime motivated by racial or other prejudice. It is a convenient way for the system to remove from our historical memory, many of us, to remove from our historical memory the possibility, the very real possibility. In fact, I would just say it is the fact that this event, this crime, this killing, this mass killing is very much a repeat of the kinds of killings we have seen before. The fact that there may be a couple of years difference, even a couple of centuries difference between the regularity of these events or the the intensity and devastation of these events is immaterial. The fact is, we have seen the dynamic before. And a certain part of our population, specifically African Americans, would be insane to accept the carefully choreographed definitions of these things, to remove the severity of it, and to cleanse these things, to cleanse our historical memory, and pretend, well, this is just, you know, a lost young man, or even if he is a member of a, quote, hate group and whatnot, that there is no historical memory associated with this at all. Isn't it ironic? The U.S. Attorney General is an African-American woman. Six of the victims are African-American women. Three are African-American men. And yet, as an official within the system, she is forced to present her options to the nation as the highest level prosecutor in the country, that this is a hate crime. It will be investigated as such, as a hate crime. And that is the extent to which the system is permitting itself to go in dealing with this. So we get word from the system, whatever happened before, forget that. It's a new day. We have a black woman now. She's a twofer. We had a black man before her, Eric Holder as U.S. Attorney General. Now we have a twofer. We've gone one better. We have a black woman. That's 2 points. She's black. She's a woman. And yet, immediately, we can see how constricted she is allowing herself to be, because that's what the system has devised. The system has devised her system that compels her to erase history and compels her to remind us or to tell us that we too ought to do the same. We ought to make no links at all to between this event, this mass killing, and any other mass killing like it that goes maybe a couple of hundred years ago or as recently as the 50s. Don't erase your historical memory. This is a new day. And this is what I mean about systems. I talked about it, and I talked about the fact that we have to get real about things. Because while many in this community of Charleston, South Carolina, where this church is located, many are inclined today to suspend the reality, their consciousness of reality that they're living in. They're content to do that. And instead, grapple onto the delusion that there has been progress. Now, some people would say I'm inviting a sense of paranoia, but it's not about paranoia. It is about what happens to create an oppressed class. Now, these people will never tell you, for the most part, that they feel oppressed in any way. But the facts tell you that. That in 2015, you are subject to the same summary justice, race-based summary justice, that existed 2 centuries ago, 3 centuries ago. You're still subjected to it. It hasn't changed. The power equation has not shifted at all. So when these things happen, they're not to be severed from a history that is well documented and that you know. It should return you to that history immediately. And it should force you to confront the fact that for whatever reason, you are divorced from a very important reality. And that reality is important because it is linked to your survival. That is the whole point of history. That is the whole point of coming through horrible times that have been paved with the blood of people who came before you. It is still happening. The power equation is still happening to the point where the actor, the chief actor in this tragedy, is now a young kid, 21 years old, who internalized already, has already given himself permission by virtue of his socialization and his history, where he operates, his world tells him that he can do this. And he can do this to this group of people. Having the nerve, in fact, it is reported, to have said to a woman who had witnessed this horrible event that he was going to let her live so that she can tell the story of what she personally witnessed. That's an incredible statement of a warped mind and a warped sense of where you are, a warped sense of power, but at the same time, a logical consequence of a particular kind of socialization that is, in that world, very, very real. So if people want to just go willy-nilly and sing We Shall Overcome and hold hands, in fact, there was a rather disturbing picture today. I'm sure it wasn't meant to be disturbing. It was meant to be quite the opposite, to comfort the nation and to document to visually document a reaction, because this is about media management. And media management, you had members of Congress, black and white, holding hands with the backdrop of Congress behind them, singing whatever it is and praying and together and all of that stuff. As if that has anything. I'm sure they were well-meaning and whatnot, but it's a choreographed event. But it is also meant to say, we have progressed. Do not be alarmed. Do not return to your history. Do not dredge up the history of America and the history of white-on-black terrorism in service of, and as a direct consequence of the socialization of white supremacy. What it does, it produces defects and it produces bloodbaths. Well, I'm not trying to be extreme here, but this was the point I was trying to make all week last week about getting real. This is our reality. And the system will tell us it is not really the reality. Instead, do not return to that history because it no longer applies. It is now to be a figment of our collective imagination. These are aberrant behaviors. And these are, kind of isolated incidents. They bear no connection whatsoever to our apartheid existence. So don't link them. See it the way we want you to see it, which is, this is an isolated incident. Tragic, yes, but isolated. Here's the other part. You may recall that just last week I talked about the Progressive National Baptist Convention going to Washington, D.C., and the aim of that is to implore the government, the system, to do the right thing and protect the voting rights of African Americans under provisions of the Voting Rights Act of 1964. I talked about the mathematics of that, that we should at least be real and admit that the Voting Rights Act actually is a long-delayed outcome from the passage of the so-called passage, and one would assume the enforcement of the 15th Amendment that, in fact, affirmed the voting rights specifically of African Americans in 1870. But how long did it take before the actual Voting Rights Act was passed? Why was there a need for a Voting Rights Act if in 1870 we had the passage of the 15th Amendment? And the Voting Rights Act of 1964, which became effective in 1965, still didn't do the job, because here we are in 2015 still discussing whether how to compel the government to obey the Constitution. And people in the leadership of this august body, rather than taking a position that it should publicly condemn the government, it should publicly persuade the millions of African Americans that it has at its disposal every Sunday in their various churches, that they ought to stop voting. Why are you voting if you have no protections of the law? Nobody's reinforcing the law. Then stop the business of self-annihilation. Now, here's a link. This church in South Carolina, the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, is the oldest and largest AME congregation in the South. And more than that, it was founded by Denmark Vesey. He was one of the founders of this congregation. Denmark Vesey, for those of you who are not familiar with the name, was enslaved in Charleston, South Carolina. He was a man of the cloth. Obviously, he founded a church. But his philosophy, and the philosophy of the founders of this church, by the way, do not let it escape your attention, that they called it the African Methodist Episcopal Church. Because even within the church community, the Episcopalians had no respect for black folks. So the blacks went and founded a church within and specifically to underscore the African identity, the African Methodist Episcopal Church. They did not apologize for that. And their attitude was not accommodation with the system, but confrontation with it, even to the point that Denmark Vesey paid for this with his life, urging at one point rebellion against a system of government dedicated to the annihilation of people of African descent. Now, that was in the 1800s. And you have to ask, look, if you severed any relationship at all, you would come up with what we are coming up with now, that this is one of the oldest, it sounds nice and mild, it's one of the oldest and the largest AME congregations. No, we should also connect with the fact that there has been a dilution of spirit between the time this church was founded and its intended purpose, and now, in terms of accommodation with a system. You see how it all ties together. It all ties together. And then we look at the larger picture, which I raised last week, where the leadership, the spiritual leadership that in the 1800s was very clear about what had to be done in service of the oppressed people, what had to be done, what their reality was, what they had to do, what they had to deal with, what they should never forget. We have widespread within the leadership of Black America the exact opposite mindset, accommodation, so that we can boast of progress. And what did I say? Progress requires regress. You have to go back. You cannot sever your past and pretend that somehow your present represents progress. It just doesn't work that way. So you got to get real. So this massacre in South Carolina, on several levels, ought to jerk our historical chains. The whole society, not just Black people. What do these things mean? What is the context in which we ought to see these things? Only then can we see some degree of progress. But again, if we accept the idea, a system becomes a system because it is scientific about what it sets out to do. It leaves practically nothing to chance on any level. It is methodical, it is scientific, and this form of terrorism also is part of the science of oppression. We'll take this break and I'll come back and talk about another warped application of science right after this. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. I have to share with you a story I read just yesterday. It was posted yesterday from Live Science. And it caught my eye because it actually was addressing some of the things that I've been talking about here. But I want to read you the story so you can appreciate the context and you can see the system, quote unquote, at work. All right. Now, of course, this concerns this question of racial identity. And here's the story. It's headlined, "The Science of Race: Why Rachel Dolezal Can't Choose to be Black." It's written by Tia Goes. I'm going to read you the story as written. The media and the public have been buzzing about the bizarre case of Rachel Dolezal, the former head of the Spokane, Washington chapter of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, who says she identifies as Black despite being born white. In a Today Show interview that aired yesterday, June the 16th, Dolezal hinted at a mismatch between her appearance and how she saw herself from a young age. Quote, "I was drawing self-portraits with the brown crayon instead of the peach crayon and black curly hair," unquote, Dolezal said in the interview. But just how common is it for people to have such discord between internal and external definitions of their race and ethnicity. While many people feel some internal tension regarding their race or ethnicity, especially during adolescence, the lengths Dolezal went into in order to cover up her birth race are incredibly unusual, experts said. Quote, kids will take on hip-hop culture or Latino culture based on their neighborhood, the schools, their community composition, but it's not something that would be lasting because it wouldn't be reinforced by people around them, said Anita Thomas, a health and psychology researcher at Loyola University Chicago who studies racial and ethnic identity. Ethnicity is a complicated mix of customs, traditions, and behaviors that are rooted in heritage, Thomas said. Most people get cues about their ethnicity from family, society, and the media, and most people don't identify with all of the canonical traits ascribed to a given ethnicity, such as enjoying spicy food or having a close-knit extended family, Thomas said. Though ethnic identity is often confused with racial identity, the two concepts are very different, said John Cheng, a historian of comparative racial and ethnic studies at Binghamton University in New York. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, scientists believed, quote, a race was the equivalent of a subspecies so that it had meaningful biological utility. But no scientist has believed that since the 1950s, unquote, Cheng told Live Science. In fact, race has no biological meaning, several experts said. Populations with different ancestry may have different prevalence of certain genes, including the relatively small number that produce traits stereotypically associated with a race, such as silky black hair in Asian people. But that handful of genes is just the tip of the iceberg, with many more genes that are invisible to bystanders showing up at different rates in populations of different ancestry. For instance, certain genes associated with heart failure risk are more common in African Americans, but society doesn't consider those genes a sign of being black. There are no black or Asian genes that define one's race, said David Freund, a historian at the University of Maryland in College Park, who studies the history of racial science, conflict, and identity. Race and ethnicity are both 100% invented by modern societies, Freund told Life Science. Just because race is constructed by society, however, doesn't mean its real-life consequences are nil or that race is malleable, he added. Race is a hierarchical system of classifying people on four or five visible characteristics, such as skin color and hair texture, in order to confer certain privileges to one group and to disempower and discriminate against another, Freund said. And crucially, society plays a big part in defining race. Few people have the option of choosing their racial identity, he added. Well, I'll stop there because the article goes on for quite a bit longer, but the essential points have been conveyed. So here we have, going back to my contention, race is a science. It is an applied science. Now, and race is a science of power and control. That's one thing that needs to be clear. But here, we also have the interesting explanation in this article that part of the science also is propagating myth, propagating a very crucial myth. We have the statement here that there's no such thing, there's no biological construct for race. And yet we have scientists in this article discussing the validity of applying a construct that has no basis in science. You see how it goes? They are confused. That doesn't mean you ought to be. So there isn't a biological construct for race. It was all invented by scientists in service of a system that would use this concept to achieve domination and control and power over everybody else. So race was the best way the system saw, the elite, the power elite saw, to use this construct that has held us all as hostages in this bizarre, illegitimate discussion about race. There is no biological construct for race, but yet it was invented, and yet we have scientists now defending something that has no basis in biological fact, no basis in science. You see how messed up they are. Why do we need to feed into that? Race, says Freud, race and ethnicity are both 100% invented by modern societies. Well, I disagree with the modern societies part, because we have historical evidence that in the course of human existence, we've had all kinds of episodes in which one group of people sought to dominate the other and invented a reason to do so. It happens in the United States. This issue of race, this figment, this scientific figment of race, was made very real and legitimized by the scientific community. So why are we feeding into it? We're feeding into it because, number one, we have no choice. So much happens in life. I just talked about it just at the beginning of the program as an example. So much happens in our collective existence based on this false notion, this false construct of race, that we can't ignore it. We have to deal with it as the necessary reality we all share. But we ought to have very different understandings about it and the application of race, because we have different experiences with it and different consequences have applied to different groups. The oppressed have an entirely different experience with race than oppressed people have with race. And it continues. And it is logical to understand that. So in the case of Dolezal, I mean, I find the discussion about her particular situation, really getting tedious at this moment. We ought to be clear about what is happening there. But we should not ignore the fact that in any event, whatever it is you think about her particular situation, look beyond that and see what is it all about. This notion of race and ethnicity, the pillars of the formation of our collective history as a nation. It did not exist, this biological construct did not exist before they got here, the European presence in the United States, and the determination to set up a system of control, utter and complete control over all, practically all aspects of life, using this pernicious thing. And of course, other nations around the world saw what incredible success was had for a power elite using this method. Colonialism used it, imperialism used it, Even socialism used it to distinguish the power elite and the others. And here we are, stuck in 2015 with the same discussion. And we refuse to go beyond it. And we refuse to draw the line and say, you know, this issue of race and ethnicity, racial inferiority / racial superiority, this dichotomy, this is symptomatic, really, of the psychotic problems with the power elite. The very idea that you could manufacture something that just cannot be validated by science, and yet you propagate it as a science, if that doesn't tell you how warped and sick the power elite of this country really are, I mean, I don't know what else would convince you. But you point these things out not to just educate people about what they ought to think, but more so what they ought to be doing. What you ought to be doing. This massacre in South Carolina brings us right back to the primordial days of the United States of America, the formation of the United States of America. Now, people would say 2015 has nothing to do with 1619 or with the arrival of Christopher Columbus in the so-called New World. But it's all linked. It's the same mindset. It has not changed. It has employed perhaps different tactics. It has not changed. You may think that Rachel Dolezal's individual action is exactly that. It's an individual action. But I just talked to you yesterday. We are talking about race and the dynamic of race, and the flack that she's getting is that she embraced or chose to embrace what the power elite sees as the losing side. And yet she still has the option to change her mind and go right back to being white. This is the nature of white supremacy in this country. You have the power to do whatever you want to do. But we are not talking. The system does not accommodate the thought about all the whites, the millions of whites who are defecting to white supremacy. They may change their names. They may get plastic surgeries to de-emphasize stereotypical or what they have stereotyped physiognomies to hide their so-called racial and ethnic identities. But millions and millions and millions of whites defect on the basis of their understanding about white supremacy. They want to belong. We want to be part of the power elite. They weren't permitted because they did not physically, by this false science, they did not physically look white the way whiteness was defined in this country. Consequently, the Irish were not white. Italians, absolutely not white. We still don't know if they have been permitted fully into the realm of whiteness. It's not official yet, but it's kind of like, well, yeah, we turn a blind eye. We let you in because a new reality is confronting white America. And it's called 2043. In 2043, the nation absolutely would have shifted demographically, and the power elite will not rest. The power would not rest strictly with the people who have defined themselves as white. It will now, at the very least, be shared with a bunch of people who never were classified as white. You see how it works? It's so warped. But you can't accept their illogic as logic. You have to come to grips with the reality and see how bizarre the thinking is. And yet it has stood the test of time because they are in control of making it appear that this is the embodiment of really high-level thinking, of the best intentions for democracy and freedom and equality and all that kind of nonsense. These people don't know what they're doing. They're messed up in the head. But I'm concerned not about them. They have already made their program very clear. The question I raise is, what about us? What are we doing? Why do we insist on going along for the ride? Why will we not interrupt this psychotic behavior? When back in the 1800s, people were real clear. They were very clear about, they had no illusions about where they stood with the system. They had no illusions about what they had to do and what the work that was important among themselves for their survival in the immediate future and their long-term survival for the generations coming behind them. They had no illusions whatsoever. So how did we lose that absolute necessity? How did we lose I'm fumbling because it is so pressing, such a crisis. How did we lose the guts to embrace our reality and begin the task of undoing the conditioning and concentrating on moving ahead with the intelligence that we can garner, even if we just revisit the past and see what happened and linked and were to link these things to our current conditions? This is the work we have to do. This is the work we have to do. And this is how we have to see things. Always see things in context. I tell you all the time, do not pretend, even if the media does, that everything that happens is isolated and, you know, fell out of the sky like a hailstone. No. We know there is context here. There almost always is a direct link to the past that continues to survive and thrive in the present, that is designed to do one group of people a lot of good and the vast majority of the others a lot of bad. We do ourselves a great injustice by ignoring our history, our collective history. I mean, the correct collective history and our history as different peoples. We all have different experiences, which are perfectly legitimate. And we have to see how they fit into this thing we call progress. Well, I'm going to leave it here today, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak with you again. We are looking forward to our phones becoming operational very soon so we can engage directly with each other as we customarily have and talk about the issues of the day, contributing to a dialogue here. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, and let me know what you're thinking. Send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com. I'm delighted, really, to be here with you, and I'm so grateful to be sharing this information with people I consider an extended family. Thank you for the honor and privilege of being in your company. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.